From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
When I got there, Bill Walsh had left and George Seifert was the coach. But if you looked at the assistants that he had, I got to know some really good coaches. And it helped when I went to the next level at USA Today. And I'm talking about Mike Shanahan was there, Jeff Fisher was there, Mike Holmgren was there, Ray Rhodes was there, Denny Green flowed through there, Ray Sherman flowed through there. And I'm probably missing a few others. I mean, there were some other coaches. But that was pretty good to get to learn from those guys, in addition to just being around that team that was like in the hunt for the Super Bowl. So that was a great experience. And then USA Today called. Here's how I got hired at USA Today. The paper that I worked for in San Francisco was the Marin Independent Journal. And it was owned by Gannett, which owns USA Today. So everything that I wrote about the 49ers, and especially, you know, like I said, it's a hot team, everything went on the Gannett News Service wire.
Jared Bell, NFL columnist for USA Today Sports and ESPN's NFL Insiders. Bell has covered the National Football League for more than three decades, first as a reporter for the Marin Independent Journal, covering the San Francisco 49ers and the Dallas Cowboys for the Dallas Cowboys Weekly, and now as an NFL columnist for USA Today Sports. Also, for 17 years, he has been a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame Selection Committee. And recently, he has added NFL Insiders on ESPN to his resume. Over the past 6 months, Bell has covered the NFL's owners' meeting, the NFL concussion litigation, the NFL draft, and the Washington Redskins name controversy. He has also written about the two different standards for a person's conduct in regards to owner management and players, and the number of underclassmen that entered the NFL draft this year. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the National Football League with Jared Bell, NFL columnist for USA Today Sports and NFL Insiders, In Black America.
Yeah, it has been. So you had 98 underclassmen declare for the draft. And if you go back the year before, it was 70-something. If you go back 5 years, it's double, okay? So it is a trend, and I think it's a trend that's going to stay for a couple of reasons. One, you know, the money in football is just too much of a draw for these guys that want to make that a career. And I think I talked to Buffalo Bills coach Doug Marrone about this a few weeks ago, to see what he thought about the numbers. And the reason why I wanted to talk to Marrone, John, was because he had coached on the NFL level, went to the college level, then came back to the NFL level. So I wanted to get his perspective on it. And it was interesting what he said. He said, you know, there's just so much pressure on these kids, not only from agents and stuff, from the family members and anybody else that's connected to them, that they are ready to jump, you know, as soon as they can.
In the 2014 NFL draft, 98 underclassmen were granted special eligibility for the draft. That's up from 73 last year, 65 in 2012, and 56 in 2011, all of which were records. The total rises to 102 when including four players who informed the NFL they graduated. Players who use up their college eligibility can apply for the draft if they are at least 3 years removed from their high school graduating class and submit a written application. The National Football League is composed of 32 teams divided equally between the National Football Conference and the American Football Conference. The NFL was formed on August 20 of 1920 as the American Professional Football Conference. After two name changes, it became the NFL on June 24th, 1922. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Jared Bell has been covering the National Football League for more than three decades. After spending his teen years hanging out at Olympia Stadium where the Detroit Red Wings played back in the day, he decided sports was the area in which he wanted to make a living. Recently, Bell was in Dallas, Texas on a Dallas Cowboys assignment.
You know what the really cool thing was about covering the 49ers, especially like after covering the Cowboys and Tom Landry and Jimmy Johnson and all his people and getting to know that group, the 49ers coaches, man, you know, when I got there, Bill Walsh had left and George Seifert was the coach. But if you looked at the assistants that he had, I got to know some really good coaches. And it helped when I went to the next level at USA Today. And I'm talking about Mike Shanahan was there, Jeff Fisher was there, Mike Holmgren was there, Ray Rhodes was there, Denny Green flowed through there, Ray Sherman flowed through there. And I'm probably missing a few others. I mean, there were some other coaches, but that was pretty good to get to learn from those guys, in addition to just being around that team that was like in the hunt for the Super Bowl. So that was a great experience. And then USA Today called. Here's how I got hired at USA Today. The paper that I worked for in San Francisco was the Marin Independent Journal. And it was owned by Gannett, which owns USA Today. So everything that I wrote about the 49ers, and especially, you know, like I said, it was a hot team, everything went on the Gannett News Service wire. And so it was available to all the Gannett papers that wanted it, really. But, you know, primarily San Bernardino, Stockton, Reno, those papers out west, they wanted the 49ers stuff every day, just like I was a regular beat writer for them, which is cool. One week, I had, well, actually about a 3 or 4 day period, I had the three biggest stories on the beat. The 49ers had just acquired Tim Harris from the Green Bay Packers in a trade. And before Harris played in his first game, he landed in jail. And he'd had problems in Green Bay. That was why the Packers were wanting to trade him. And he ends up in jail, and I get the scoop. One of the 49ers security guards casually told me, oh, yeah, I had to go get Tim Harris out of jail. What? Okay, so got that scoop. Then 2 days later, the 49ers played the Falcons, and they lost. And you know, all hell was about to break loose, right? They were 2-4. They just lost to the Falcons, right, who weren't very good at that time. And so instead of going to George Seifert's press conference, I went straight to the locker room after the game when they opened, because they would open up the locker room when the coach started his press conference, which was in another room down the hall. So I went in the locker room, and there was only one other reporter there. And I look across the room, and he's getting the same reaction I'm getting. None of the players would talk. You go up to them, even the money players that always were nice and would talk to you, you know, Jamie Williams, no, he ain't got nothing to say. Steve Young, nope. Jerry Rice, everybody's lips were zipped. So I go over to the corner, and I see Eddie DeBartolo, the team owner, in the corner. And I didn't find out till later what had happened and why everybody was so quiet, because DeBartolo had just went off and reamed the team. So when I caught him with the other reporter on the other side of the room, he went off, and it was all on the record, you know, and he was cussing and talking about people's heads was gonna roll and all of this. And so I had this great story. Eddie DeBartolo blows up, okay? Rips the 49ers, rips Seifert, you know, and it was all on the record, right? And then about three to five minutes later, the other reporters come into the locker room after Seifert finished his press conference, and they see Eddie DeBartolo, and they catch Eddie DeBartolo, and they ask him for his reaction. And he says, well, at times like this, it's, you know, we have to stick together as a team. And he was just so positive. It was just a total different guy than what I got. So the next day, everybody else had DeBartolo saying, you know, be cool and calm. And I had DeBartolo blows up. And he actually had a press conference that next day. And they said he had never done that before. He actually had it was a conference call. He had a conference call the next day. And the first thing he said was, hey, Jarrett was right. You know, y'all just caught me. Y'all just caught me after I had cooled down. But there was nothing inaccurate about what he reported. I was like, yes, Eddie. So I had that scoop. And then the next day after that, I had the scoop that Joe Montana was having his elbow surgery the next day. And that had been an ongoing story about what Montana was going to do. He wasn't playing at the time, obviously. He was trying to heal this elbow injury without having surgery. He kept having setbacks, so this went on for several weeks. Finally, he decided to have surgery. I got the scoop. Nobody else had it. And then, like, the next day, USA Today called and said, we think we want you to come and check us out. And that's kind of how I got, well, that is. That's how I got hired by USA Today. So there was never, like, a interview process or anything like that. They just kind of, like, said, you coming here.
To the 18, because you were already working for Gannett anyway.
Basically, yeah. But what I did, after the football season, I went and worked for them for, like, 3 months. And they had what they called a loaner program with Gannett. And then I went back to cover the 49ers for one more year before I went full-time with USA Today.
As we speak, Chuck Noll, long tenure, 23 years tenured coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers, passed away. Not knowing him personally or covered, what impact did he as a coach and in the city of Pittsburgh did he have on the league?
Yeah, you know, Chuck Noll was the glue for those great Steelers teams of the 70s. And, you know, the record speaks for itself. He's the first and only coach to win 4 Super Bowls, okay? But looking beyond that, think about, and a lot of people don't know, unless you're old enough to know, how bad the Steelers were before Chuck Noll. Yeah. He got there in 1969, and they had 13 coaches in the previous 30-something years of the franchise's existence. So Chuck Noll stabilized all that, built through the draft, and, you know, that was a time when you could keep teams together, but you had to still have a team worthwhile to keep together. And so that was the legacy that he really just kind of turned the whole fortunes of the franchise around. But as you listen to the former Steelers talk about him and even some of the other writers who covered him during the 70s and the 80s, and they told you that he was just a swell guy who was super intelligent without a big ego. I mean, he never wrote a book, okay? You know, winning all those Super Bowls and stuff. And the Steelers players, and like I said, even the writers will tell you what they learned from Chuck Noll, so many things. He was a well-rounded guy. And you know, respect it ultimately. I think bottom line, John, he probably doesn't get as much credit as being one of the greatest coaches of all time, and maybe that's because of his personality. Even his era, you think Landry, Shula, and then, you know, before that, you know, Lombardi, Paul Brown. Well, Chuck Noll really deserves to be in the conversation with those other coaches as one of the greatest ever.
Let's talk about this most recent NFL draft. Everyone's talking about, you know, Johnny Football. But let's talk about the number of underclassmen who made themselves eligible. Is that something that's going to be a trend going forward?
Yeah, it has been. So you had 98 underclassmen declare for the draft. And if you go back the year before, it was 70-something. If you go back 5 years, it's double, okay? So it is a trend. And I think it's a trend that's going to stay for a couple of reasons. One, you know, the money in football is just too much of a draw for these guys that want to make that a career. And I think I talked to Buffalo Bills coach Doug Marrone about this a few weeks ago to see what he thought about the numbers. And the reason why I wanted to talk to Marrone, John, was because he had coached on the NFL level, went to the college level, then came back to the NFL level. So I wanted to get his perspective on it. And it was interesting what he said. He said, you know, there's just so much pressure on these kids, not only from agents and stuff, from the family members and anybody else that's connected to them, that they are ready to jump, you know, as soon as they can. And so I know the league is really trying to get its hands around it and working with the colleges to try to curb those numbers. But I think it's going to be difficult when a player thinks he's good enough to play, even though he might be a better prospect a year later. I mean, Jadeveon Clowney, number one pick in the draft, you can't fault him for coming out, right? A really supreme, and even Johnny Manziel, a supremely talented guy. But you had about half these guys that declared that did not get drafted. And I think that's where the real problem is, because guys could better prepare themselves by staying in school. And they could, by the way, get an education that can help them if they don't make it in football. And I think too many guys look at the opportunity of the NFL as, you know, as a meal ticket, which it could be. And so the temptation's there. You say, hey, let me go and start early, and then when I get to that second contract, I've got less wear and tear on my body. I think that's kind of part of the thought process. I can't say I totally blame them. I understand it because they're getting used up by the colleges, right? So I understand that, but I think it's a real fine line because not everybody is going to be Cam Newton. Not everybody's going to go into the NFL and become J.J. Watt. Not everybody is going to go into the NFL and be a smashing success. And I think if guys can really take stock of that as they move forward, it might help some make some better decisions. Because like I said, about half the guys did not get drafted. That doesn't mean they won't have a chance at a career, but it kind of tells you where they're starting from, and that's not a good place.
Recently, almost recently, four owners have recently passed away. Obviously, there's a change in the guard and ownership. Are these particular franchises remaining in the family, or are there going to be new people coming on board?
It's kind of a mixed bag. Let's say this. Most of them are staying in the family. So the Detroit Lions lose William Clay Ford, right, and that's going to stay in the Ford family. Malcolm Glazer with the Bucks, that's staying in the Glazer family. Now, Ralph Wilson passing with the Buffalo Bills, yeah, right, his wife Mary is in the process of selling the franchise. And the big question there, John, is whether the team will stay in Buffalo. That's kind of what they want to do. But until these deals are done, sometimes you don't know.
Three sons running the team on a day-to-day basis?
On the Ralph? Bills? No. That's the Glazers.
The Glazers, okay.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
The Glazers have the sons that are entrenched. And that's a good point to make because there are some franchises, just like the Cowboys and Jerry Jones, where the families are intimately involved in a day-to-day basis. So Jerry's got, you know, two sons and a daughter,
right,
who have been executives for many years along the way with him. So in situations like that with the Glazers, you don't expect much will change in terms of the philosophy of the franchise. But with Buffalo, no, Ralph Wilson pretty much had other people empowered to run the operation, and now they're going to sell the team. And so you don't know what the ramifications are going to be for those top-level people once they sell the team. But again, you know, Ralph Wilson wanted the team to stay in Buffalo, and that's kind of one of the preconditions of a potential sale. But sometimes, if you can't get a buyer to agree to that at the level you want, then you may have to have another alternative as well.
A couple of controversies. They might be controversies to you. Washington Redskins.
Oh, big time.
Are the Redskins going to be, one, remain in Washington, and are they always going to be mascotted as the Redskins?
No, I don't think. I think the time has come that I think the clock is ticking, basically. You know, when the time has come to change it. Probably the time was there long ago to change it, but the momentum is different. And if you go back to history, John, this is not an entirely new issue. You can go back to the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, and you had opposition. But it's different now because we're in a different time. And so the pressure now seems to be more intense, and it's mounting almost by the day. I mean, you just had 50 senators sign a declaration saying that the team should change its nickname. Now, Dan Snyder has been very stubborn in saying that he will never change the name. But right now, there's a trademark case pending with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that could essentially strip the Redskins of trademark protection for that name. And so it cannot force him to change the name, but what it could do is prevent him from suing you, John, if you wanted to go print Washington Redskins paraphernalia and sell it. Right now, if you were to do that, you could get sued. Or if you did that for the Dallas Cowboys or, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers, you could be sued for that. If this trademark case goes against the Redskins, and it still could take many years when you consider the appeals, et cetera. But if it ultimately becomes the case where they have no protection, that's going to be a factor. That still may not be enough to make them change the name of the team. I think it's going to have to be public pressure or really NFL league pressure. And I think a couple things have happened. Number one, the Oneida Nation is really empowered economically to carry this fight to the finish, really, because they have done an enormous job of keeping the issue alive in so many different ways, and they've connected with so many other civil rights organizations and other entities to keep applying the pressure. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think even if you look at the numbers of the people when they are polled on this, it has shifted. It has shifted incrementally over the years in terms of how many people accept the name. And it goes back to our American history and what's acceptable now in a progressive society. So I've been very outspoken and written a number of columns denouncing the team for that and Snyder, and hadn't changed his mind yet. But I think there are a lot, and you can look at so many different organizations, Sports Illustrated and Peter King, the San Francisco Chronicle, other media outlets have decided not to even use the term.
With the few minutes that we have left, are we having a double standard with the personal conduct policy that the NFL has? One set of rules for the owners, another set of rules for the players and management?
Yeah, that question's come up a few times with Jimmy Irsay being arrested and having a case pending. A couple things. It's a fair question, but the method that Roger Goodell has used in this case is really more similar to what he has done with players since Bountygate. Okay. That was kind of the defining line. And so it's easy to say, hey, he's not slamming Irsay like he did the players. And just, you know, bottom line, Goodell expects that there's going to be some discipline for Irsay. We know he's already damaged the NFL's reputation. Yes, owners should be, there should be a double standard. They should be held at a higher standard, mm-hmm. right? And so Goodell has said he will get around to doing that once all of the facts of his case are resolved, okay? So that's assuming they go through the legal situation right. mm-hmm. in Indiana, and whatever charges stick, then he can discipline him accordingly. Now, he's doing the same thing now with NFL players. So you have Alden Smith, who's got a case pending with the 49ers linebacker. Ray Rice okay. Has had a situation, a domestic situation that is close to being resolved. At least it seems to be resolved on one level. But before Bountygate, Roger Goodell would slam people right off the bat before they would have their day in court. Right. I mean, it happened with Ben Roethlisberger was never formally charged for his situation with the female, but or formally convicted, I'm sorry. And so he still got a suspension. Pac-Man Jones had a number of issues that did not result in him serving any jail time. Mm-hmm. But he still got suspended by the NFL for like a year. And so there were so many cases like that. And then when the Bounty case came up with the New Orleans Saints, you know, Goodell threw the book at him. And I think the fact that there were so many holes in the NFL's case with the Saints changed how Goodell operated moving forward. And so now that's what we're seeing. So it's almost like it's two different eras, the pre-Bountygate and the post-Bountygate. So when people say, well, there's a double standard, Irsay and the players, yeah, it's a double standard if you want to compare Irsay to the pre-Bountygate mm-hmm. discipline that Goodell handed out and how quickly he handed it out. But since Bountygate, no, he's been very deliberate because he's gotten a lot of criticism, frankly, from the players' union. And you can't blame the players' union for really trying to pursue it in that manner because, as you saw in the Saints case, the league kind of did jump the gun.
Good segue. NFLPA executive director position vote coming up next year.
Yeah, DeMora Smith, you know, he got reelected a couple years ago. I think it might be tougher now.
Is the CBA or the schedule?
Oh no, it's the labor deal still.
Okay.
And you know, the players union people will tell you that this deal was not a bad deal for the players, but you talk to some of the veteran guys who've had some trouble getting jobs, and they will tell you otherwise. The players' union will also tell you that it's a 10-year labor deal, which is the longest that they've ever had, and it's going to reflect more favorably as the deal goes, as it goes forward. But I think there's been enough consternation on a few fronts that if a legitimate challenger comes forward, then DeMora Smith could be in trouble. I'm not going to say that he's going to not be reelected because I don't know if there's a formidable challenger right now. Now, Sean Gilbert, the former defensive tackle who has become a critic, has launched a campaign. It hasn't really been very public at this point, but he has given all the indications and has declared that he's going to try to take DeMora Smith's job. And I'm hearing that there's some other people who could enter the fray before next spring. So DeMora Smith may have a challenge, but I think the thing that he's got going for him is the fact that they've kind of moved forward and he's a different type of union leader than they had in Gene Upshaw. In fact, he will fight the NFL. So if you like that, I think that was kind of one of the keys to him getting elected in the first place. He came with an outside voice, an outside perspective, and he's done some really good things in terms of, you know, really pushing the players' issues and things like workers' comp.
Jared Bell, NFL columnist for USA Today Sports and ESPN's NFL Insiders. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.